A pause for reflection today on Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Roald and I are sitting 6 feet apart in our studio home today on Scribble. So we're not at home.
No, and I am closer to you than I have been to any other human being besides Margaret for 2 weeks. My kids come over and bring things or talk, but they talk from the next room. I haven't seen my daughter at all.
Well, you know, you're partly obscured from me right now because even though we are 6 feet apart, you know, we don't know enough about this stuff. We really don't know enough about coronavirus. We know a lot. We know the ravage it does to the lungs. Boy, I don't know if you've seen the x-rays and such, but they're really terrible.
I just heard on the news, if you were listening to VIK, you heard it too, just before coming into the studio, that it is rapidly resurrecting itself in China.
Yeah.
And so they don't know whether that's a different strain or what is happening. I mean, we don't have any handle on this beast at all.
Well, I do not pretend to be any kind of authority on this, but from what I've read of it, you know, it seems to come from bats. And apparently bats are full of viruses and so on, and the coronavirus, you know, aggressively works to take over cells and multiply itself. And in order to stay alive, the bat's cells fight against that. They build up defenses. So the coronavirus evolves further to be stronger. And this warfare goes on in bats constantly until finally the bat dies, which means when this virus gets out of bats, boy, it's strong. It's ready to go. And we're dealing with it now because it's jumped up to us. And who knows how it will continue to evolve. And one of the things that, you know, we're talking about, we got to get back to work, got to open things up. Okay, but remember, it's coming, even if it goes away this summer, and we're not sure it will, it's going to come back in the fall. And it'll probably come back stronger. So there's something to think about.
Well, on the other hand, at some point, we got to get back to work.
Yeah, but it's not going to be the same. I don't know how, you know, I don't know what the new normal is going to be. Do you?
Well, it you know, most countries are doing what we are doing, sheltering in place. In Sweden, they've never done that.
That's an interesting experiment, and we'll see how it works its way through Sweden.
Well, so far it seems to be not much worse than it would be if they were sheltering in place. They don't shelter in place because they said, you know, the only way to get rid of it is let it take its course, and that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
Which we could have done, too, at the cost of many more lives.
And that's the thing, too. How many people are you willing to sacrifice to give the entire population immunity? That seems a very cold thing to contemplate. And it's not the way we usually do things. We work to preserve as many lives as we can. I don't know how this is going to turn out. I really don't. Nobody does. But I do know that we are safely ensconced here at WVIK, 6 feet apart. with some time to kill. What is it, you know, distance, being close or being distance? You know, we hear that absence makes the heart grow fonder, or if you're gone, you're forgotten. How are we going to adjust to this? You're the professor.
I have no idea. You know, I used to see people over here every single day, and most of them I haven't seen now for 3 weeks, and it's going to be at least another 3 weeks, I'm sure, before I don't know. I have to say, I've always said, but I've never tested it out, that in a different life I could have been a hermit very comfortably. And
oh, yeah.
And everybody I know says, no, you can't. You need people. You could know more. I'm not so sure of that anymore because I think, and so has Margaret, adjusted quite well to sheltering in place alone. I mean, we do go out. She goes to the grocery store. I don't go in. But once a week, we talk on the phone and stuff to people. But a hermit might not be a bad life. I'm getting a lot of reading done, even more thinking. It turns out I'm doing more thinking than I am reading these days.
You know, I've discovered early on, after my, I don't know if I've told you this before, at my age I've told all my stories over and over again, but after I finished my sophomore year in high school, I was at a Catholic school and Sister Amedia was the biology teacher. I very much admired her. I found out that I learned so much from Amedia, I wasn't challenged in biology until I was in my junior year in college. That's how good she was. But after that sophomore year, she was transferred to a brand new hospital that opened up in Humboldt, Tennessee, which is some distance from Memphis. And she asked if I'd like to work there with her for about 6 weeks or so. So I asked Mom, would you mind if I did that? She said, no, go ahead. So I went up to St. Mary's Hospital, which was an unusual situation. This is in the middle of the Bible Belt. They built a hospital, and the mayor talked the council into having Catholic nuns come in to staff the hospital because they were really good and they were really cheap. And the odd thing is, he was one of only 8 Catholic families in the town. And the reason he was mayor is because he was elected mayor during the Depression, and he did such an impressive job of setting the town back on its rails that they just kept electing him. So they listened to him, and they brought the nuns in. But the townspeople, boy, it was really something. If the nuns would walk downtown, people would cross the street to avoid them. They didn't want to go to the hospital at all. And the only cases we saw were just lost causes, just about. And miraculously, almost all of them came through, including one that was called the Miracle Baby, which is another story. But I was there in this hospital, and since I was very much an integrationist, I insisted that my room be on what they call the colored ward. We only had 2 patients there the whole time I was there, but that was the first time, Roald, I had a bed of my own, a regular bed, not a rollaway, and that I was alone. And I wondered, how am I going to handle this? And it was a breeze. And I discovered, yeah, I guess I'm kind of a loner. So this isn't too bad for me.
No, I think, you know, to be truthful, if I thought this was going to last forever, you know, if I had to be a hermit from now on, I think it would bother me. But it's like being poor in graduate school. You know, Margaret and I used powdered milk for milk. We boiled our coffee through at least twice through the grounds, and sometimes a third time just to make. We were living on, I think, $35 a week of food, and that included my cigarettes, which were a big part of that. But it was kind of romantic because we knew it was going to end. If I had thought that my life was going to be, you know, when the toaster wore out, we stopped having toast. And you know, it was kind of fun. Because it was almost like a game. And I guess, you know, that's my perspective. I don't know a single person who has the coronavirus.
Well, you don't know because...
No, I know, but I don't. I mean, I certainly don't know anyone who has died from it. So it's on television, just like reality television. So it that part of it somehow doesn't seem real to me.
Well, I know two friends who have coronavirus, but they're way out in the West Coast. And I don't know anyone here, but if you just look at epidemiology, it's probably, looking at the nature of this, they say that you can count on 1 in 4 having it. But most are going to be asymptomatic. You're not going to know they have it. They may not even know they have it. They probably don't know, but they can spread it. And that is the problem. The government did not move to set up testing when this first came up. And that is of many serious lacks, that is a critical one because we don't know who has it. And you don't get tested unless you start coughing heavily and have a fever. Then, yeah, they'll give you a test and tell you whether or not it's coronavirus or something else. If it is coronavirus, well, go home and, you know, stay by yourself. If it gets really bad, we'll admit you to the hospital. And then that's the test, because once it takes hold and gets going, you could get seriously ill to the point where they have to do your breathing for you on one of these ventilators. And then it's up to your lungs. Can you overcome this? Because we haven't got any medicine that'll help you.
Right.
And if you can, then you struggle back and you survive, as Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of England, did. But if you don't, then that you're another fatality. It can go slowly. It can go quickly. We just don't know.
No, it seems to behave even differently in different countries.
Well,
you know, why all of a sudden in Italy, for instance, is the death rate so high per person getting it, and high in Spain, but not terribly high in like South Korea?
Well, in South Korea, they took aggressive action immediately.
But I'm talking the percentages of people who get it.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
You know, the death rate for people who get it in South Korea is much lower than it was in Italy.
Well, I think it's because they took aggressive steps. They immediately set up a testing program to test everybody and immediately isolated people. So that cut the infection rate dramatically. Percentage of that, I don't know. I can't account for that. But, you know, there's some I've heard, and you have to be careful because there's so much garbage floating around today, passing as actual information, and the scam artists are at work full tilt. But I've heard that it actually started in two places in China, in Wuhan, and in another place where they were doing some experimental works on bats. And maybe the two somehow were related, but we honestly don't know, and I don't think we'll ever know. We know that we just have to deal with it. So you say you're doing less reading and more thinking.
I am, yes. Is it okay in this segment to mention a book?
Well, if you insist, I certainly will listen to you.
just by sheer accident, Don Erickson, a week before we got isolated by the virus, gave me a book by Lewis Hyde, whom I'd never heard at all, who turns out to be a very highly respected nonfiction writer who's only written 2 books and a small book of poetry, but whom many writers regard as the greatest living nonfiction writer in the United States today or in the world. He's got a Guggenheim. He has a MacArthur Genius Grant. This book is called A Primer for Forgetting and subtitled Getting Past the Past. And it isn't even a well-put-together book. It's just a book of little thoughts of his, some of which are half a page long, some of which might be 2.5 pages long, on what it means to forget. The Holocaust is always a good example that comes up. It's an event we should not forget in our history, but on the other hand, it's an event which, in order for there to be a culture today that that in Germany we have to somehow forget, right? I mean, and the Civil War. Look at the way in which the Civil War is remembered in the North and in the South. It's two different ball games, right? So his claim is that forgetting is just as important as remembering. That he traces that back to Greek. He does a lot of this book goes back to Greek philosophy, to Greek plays, and so forth and so on. But it's a kind of book that for me has been just perfect, because I can usually in the morning when I get up and have coffee and toast, and then I will pick up three sections of this book, maybe a total of five pages, and that's enough for me to think the whole rest of the day and on into the night about, ooh, I wonder, what about this? Well, what about that? And it's a book that the more I read, the further behind I get, because the more there is to think about. So if you want to take a book and move to a desert island or isolate yourself in your room, I would certainly recommend. It's a very heavy book to read, but if you take it in little parts, he's got some really interesting things that come up to say. What's the difference between, you know, those who remember the past forget the past are condemned to repeat it. We are so much on the side of remembering. Remember the past, remember the Maine, remember the Holocaust. But in some ways, we can't do that, right?
Well,
totally, or there would be no culture, there would be no countries.
Yeah, forgettery is just as important as a memory.
Right.
Because you can't fill your mind with too much stuff. It gets to be like an overstuffed attic. And then when you want to remember something, well, you have to paw through all sorts of things to try to come up with the answer. And as you age, as I have been doing spectacularly over the last several years, you find that your memory comes and goes and fits and starts. And suddenly you'll remember something with great clarity, but don't try to get it the next day, because it will have dodged away and something else has taken its place. You know, I brought some books today. Later on we're going to do another program on reviews. But I didn't bring this one because I have not read far into it. I can't even remember the author's name. He's the fellow who wrote Elegant Universe. He's a physicist, and he does some thinking about death and the fact that life is transitory. And he approaches that from several different directions. And the point is, we are always striving to leave a permanent marker in the world. We fight against this transient existence. We are looking for permanence. And we try to find it in being part of maybe a great institution. You know, to be, as you are, a treasured memory here at Augustana College. You're still around to deflate that
that's
memory.
That's due to an awful lot of forgetting.
Or you can lose yourself in a religion, that you can become part of that you can establish yourself as a great public servant. If you're wealthy enough, you can build a monument to yourself. You can endow something that'll go on and on and on. But everything ends. And that's the thing that we dodge away from all the time. I remember in the seminary, I forget how it came up, but I think Father Griffith said in our meditation one time that you can't make any sense of life until you have dealt with death. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because at that age, in my late teens, why would I think about death? When you're in your adolescence, you imagine that you're immortal. Nothing can happen to you. You take all kinds of risks because your brain isn't fully developed. It isn't until the forebrain is fully in place that you develop some kind of judgment. And sometimes I think in some people that never happens. But it's true that you never think that anything that you're doing or working on can end, because life is brand new. It's like brand new clothes, you know, they are so wonderful. But they're going to get wrinkled and worn out and finally discarded, and so are you. And dealing with that is something that most people don't want to do because they think it's, you know, it's frightening. But it isn't really frightening. And I remember spending some time thinking about that and accepting that, yeah, I'm going to die. And I think Pope Francis, as I've mentioned before, said something I very much agree with. I'm not afraid to die, but I'm a sissy. I hope it doesn't hurt a lot. And I can live with that. I think that's pretty good. You accept the fact that life ends. You're not in a rush to do it, because you can always find something to do, something to fill your life in any age. I know that many people become discouraged, particularly if they're left alone. And I think of all my friends, you know, I've lost legions of friends over the years, people who on whom I depended and are gone, and life goes on. There still are people who are new friends come up, but sometimes for some people they don't, and you are left alone. And that's got to be really tough. But if you look for what is available to you in life at any age, that's enough to, should be enough to keep your spirits up. We know this coronavirus can be deadly. It can be harmless. And we don't know how each one of us is going to be dealt with by this. But until that decision is made, or till that eventuates, there are things to do. I look around my house and I think, I will never live long enough to get this place clean. I will never live long enough to get rid of all these books and records. How can I dispose of things when my tendency has been to be a pack rat all my life? And I'm just enclosed with all these things. I asked my kids once and said, what are you going to do with this? You'll have to throw it away. He says, oh, we'll just turn the house into a museum.
I have projects that I've been putting off until there was time to do it. And now I've got plenty of time to do it because I have to stay in constantly. I'm still not doing them. because it seems like it's not ordinary time, this time that we're sheltering in place. I can't quite explain it, but I don't know. I could just go out and do these things. You know, now I'm up to doing like one a day, which might be watering a flower pot. But Margaret's better. I mean, Margaret is getting a lot of things done.
Women are better at everything. Man. That's the thing I've discovered through life. Women are just better equipped to deal with life because they are the center of life. Life flows through them. They understand it in a way that men don't quite. I don't mean to put us down, fellas, but the fact is that if I want to know what's going on somewhere, I talk to a woman who's involved, and she will know. She will know. She will not spend my time talking about all the wonderful things she's done and you know, build up her own importance. No, she will tell you what you want to know. I found that out when I was in the state Senate working with the staff. If I wanted to understand a bill that was confusing me, I talked to a woman who had worked on it. And she would know right to the ground, not only what was in the bill, but who was pushing it and why. And those are important things to know before you cast a vote. And I found that's generally true through life. So women do adapt. But I'm doing the best I can. I actually straightened out the many drawers in my bedroom. And found tons of things that I no longer need, put them in a bag, and going to give them to Salvation Army. And I should do that through every room in the house. But I've done one. I've done part of one.
I've done part of my room, and I it doesn't show at all. You know, I've taken out literally 10 or 12 bags of stuff that I've thrown out, and Margaret will come in and said, "When are you going to start cleaning your room out?" Well, I've done it. No, I haven't.
You know, I just sat down the last two nights and put a stack of mail, well, it covered the table, and went through it and discarded stuff I was not going to deal with. I wrote checks for things that I wanted to support, contributions to various firms, magazine renewals, and so on. And, man, I had a stack of mail to go out. And I cleared off a lot of paper. But then I turn around, and there's an equal stack of paper on another horizontal surface. As a matter of fact, on every horizontal surface I can see. And I think this is a... like Sisyphus rolling a
right.
boulder up a mountain. But I'm going to keep at it because something has to be done. I can't, if I should depart this world suddenly, what a mess I'm going to leave. So better to straighten it up. And that's something to do.
But a lot of it will be a fun mess. I you know, my mother died suddenly too, and I don't think she'd even started to clean out and stuff, but it was really fun going through even the most obscure drawers and finding green stamps and things like that. Or events that I remember where we got that particular little item. Not the big things, you know, I was familiar with those, but all the little stuff tucked away. That turned out to be a delightful little trip.
Yeah. Well, we've idled away a fair amount of time here today, but it is true that look around and see what's in your home. I opened a file drawer of my desk, and I saw a folder that I did not recognize. I thought, what the heck is that? So I pulled it out and opened it, and in there were all the things that obtained around Bernadette's funeral. All the comments from people, the emails, the messages, and so on. And it was a very moving evening, reliving all that again.
Right.
And I think there are so many things in my home that can evoke that kind of response. So I should start looking around, and so should you. Look around, see what there is, and what you can make of it. Because, you know, your life is not empty. It never has been. And it's sometimes interesting just to check back and see where you've been. And, of course, read. And that's what we should be doing, and I've done a little bit. But that big book that is just too big to read, pick it up and get going. Because why not? You have the time. You might as well use it in that direction. But we've used up our time here today, and we haven't accomplished much, but just kind of kvetch about stuff. But we'll come back for more conventional fare later on. Thank you for your time 6 feet away, Roald.
Okay.
And thank you for your time joining us for this odd ramble. We'll be back with a more conventional edition of Scribble next week. Hope you'll join us then. Scribble is produced by Media Consultants Limited for Augustana Public Radio.